Hello, JT Wheatley here, your friendly neighborhood host of the History of Comic Books podcast. Moving on to the history of Wonder Woman. Now, to finish out the DC Trinity, having previously done episodes on Superman and Batman, we now move on to the history of Wonder Woman. The origin of Wonder Woman came from one of the most unlikely and unique characters in comic book history, William Moulton Marston, whose life was almost as intriguing as his character. He was born on May 9, 1893, to Frederick William and Annie Moulton Marston in Cliftondale, Massachusetts. The family claimed ancestry back to the Norman conquest of England, thus naming him William after William the Conqueror. And as a child, young William excelled at school and would later attend Harvard University, whose motto was Veritas, truth, similar to that lasso Wonder Woman would eventually carry, where he enjoyed ancient philosophy, especially by the Greeks. At the school, he was inspired by Professor George Herbert Palmer, a faculty sponsor of the Harvard's Men's League of Women's Suffrage, whose politics he quickly identified with. Marston even credited Palmer with preventing him from committing suicide by a vial of cyanide, something that Wonder Woman's first villain, Dr. Poison, would use. It was also during his Harvard years that his relationship with his future wife, Sadie Elizabeth Holloway, intensified, someone he had known since the eighth grade. Born Elizabeth Sadie Holloway on February 20th, 1893, on the Isle of Man, and she grew up near Boston, Massachusetts, the daughter of Daisy and William George Washington Holloway, an American bank clerk. Holloway herself enjoyed Greek philosophy and history, especially the Amazons, which she identified with in her own feminist beliefs. She also loved Greek poetry, especially by Sappho, a 600 BC poet who lived on the island of Lesbos, which name would go on to inspire to turn lesbian, as she would become the symbol of love and desire between women. Suffering Sappho would, in fact, become a popular phrase Wonder Woman would utter. At Harvard, Marston did experiments with Hugo Munsterberg to detect lies, working at the Emerson Hall Psychology Lab. With his lie detection experiments, he tried using systolic blood pressure, essentially the blood pressure in the vessels of your heart when the heart beats, for detection, and noticed that it changed when the patient appeared to get more emotional. Reportedly, Sadie Holloway helped with these experiments, at least indirectly, and she is pictured in one of the lab photos. As a result, the first lie detector was created by Marston, which alone would have set his place in history, but Marston had bigger plans. While studying philosophy and doing those experiments, Marston studied How to Write a Photoplay by Herbert Case Hoagland and would sell the movie scenarios to the Edison Film Company. Jack Kennard, Coward, which was released on May 5th of 1915, about a young man branded a coward because he wouldn't play on the Harvard football team, won Marston a $100 prize when he submitted to the company. It would be the first taste Marston would have with entertainment in Hollywood. It would only grow from there. On June 25, 1915, Marston graduated from Harvard as Phi Beta Kappa with a BA, while Sadie graduated from Mount Holyoke on June 16th, and Marston proposed to her, using the money he made from Jack Kennard to buy her a ring. They were married that September, and Marston began law school at Harvard, while Sadie went to Boston University for her own law degree, because Harvard at the time didn't allow women. Marston planned to use his lie detector experiments as part of his law studies, but suffered a setback when his mentor, Hugo Munsterberg, died on December 16, 1916. As a future tribute to him, he would be the inspiration for one of Wonder Woman's chief villains, Professor Psycho. This was in part due to Marston's own disagreements with Munsterberg, who held sexist views against women, and being of German origin, sided with Germany during World War I. Quite the opposite of Marston. During World War I, Marston offered the use of his lie detector to the military on June 5, 1917. He was allowed to do further tests to show its use, which led to exceptional results, but was ultimately rejected. On June 1918, both Marston and Sadie graduated from law school, with Sadie being one of just three women to graduate with a law degree at Boston University. She would also complete the bar exam faster than Marston, who on October of that year was commissioned a lieutenant in the Army and sent to Camp Greenleaf in Georgia, while Sadie stayed home. At Greenleaf, he worked as a professor of military psychology, and it was there he met Major Lee Huntley in November of that year in Atlanta, an Atlanta, Georgia native who would later work as an inker and letter on Wonder Woman. On September of 1919, Marston returned home and enrolled in Harvard's Ph.D. program in philosophy. Sadly, tragedy would strike Marston and Sadie the next year when their first child, Federico, was born stillborn on June 7, 1920. It would affect them their entire life, and Sadie would always mention that she had three children after her two others were born. After he was discharged from the military, Marsden was having a hard time finding work. He tried everything from starting an engineering company, a fabrics firm, and even a law profession. Always failed. Marsden even tried selling his lie detector in a May 1921 ad, "Machine detects lies, traps crooks." Finally, he got his PhD on June 1921 and started work at an American university in Washington, D.C., teaching legal philosophy. There, he did experiments for jury selection on the effect the females had on them, whose conclusion he believed showed that women were better judges and more impartial. He also got involved in a real crime with the murder of Robert Brown. Robert Brown, a Washington physician, was murdered on March 10, 1922, when the police charged James Fry with a crime, claiming he had confessed after being implicated by John R. Francis, a dentist. Fry, Brown, and Francis were all black. According to his confession, Fry went to Brown for medicine for gonorrhea, and Fry accidentally shot him during a struggle after revealing he didn't have the money. However, Fry claimed his confession was a lie, and Marsden saw this as an excellent opportunity for his lie detector. It helped that Fry's lawyers, Lester Woods and Richard Mattingly, were students of his at American University, which they never disclosed to the court. Marsden and Fry had Fry tested with his lie detector and, based on his results, claimed that Fry was innocent. However, the judge on the case, Walter McCoy, objected to his use as evidence, as he didn't think it had been perfected or scientifically sound yet. On July 28, 1923, James Fry was found guilty of second-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Also of note, both Woods and Mattingly, his lawyers, got seized from Marsden and their class. The case was appealed to the U.S. D.C. Court of Appeals, where it was rejected on December 3, 1923. Fry versus the U.S. was set a legal precedent, as it stated that only scientifically proven evidence could be admitted in court. Thus, the lie detector could not, as it stands today, along with its more accurate successor, the polygraph. The Fry test, or to be fried, would become a common legal term on whatever new scientific evidence is rejected by the court, as only sound science is allowed. Marsden was incensed by the ruling and would always claim his lie detector worked to his dying day. However, he had legal trouble of his own to deal with. On March 6, 1923, Marsden was arrested for fraud, which resulted from a January 1922 lawsuit brought by Edward J. Fisher for breach of contract over the defunct law firm Marsden, Fort, and Fisher, the one he tried to start a year or so ago. He was asking for $5,000 in damages. This led to his indictment on December 1, 1922 in Massachusetts, which also included charges of mail fraud and concealment of assets from the failure of his other businesses, the bankrupt garment factory United Dress Goods. On March 16, 1923, he was arraigned, though the charges would eventually be dropped on January 4, 1924. That didn't stop American University from taking action, which promptly fired him due to the controversy. Marsden did eventually publish studies and testimony on his experiments in legal psychology on May 1924, which appeared in the Journal of Criminal Law and Criminology, but this and the Fry case soured him to the entire practice of law. He would have his revenge against Judge McCoy in the future Wonder Woman newspaper strip of March 1945, in which Judge Friendly is forced to admit her lasso of truth is admissible as evidence in a murder trial. At this point in history, feminist literature was reaching a new wave in America, with The Child of the Amazons and other poems, whose title is about an Amazonian queen who falls in love with a man in violation of Amazonian principles, and Angel Island by Inez Haynes of Gilmore in 1914, about five men marooned on an island of beautiful winged women. In Her Land in 1915, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, a world is imagined in which women live free of men and only bear daughters via paragenesis, asexual reproduction. Most significantly was Woman in the New Race by noted feminist Margaret Sanger, who argued for both birth control and women's rights and would later found Planned Parenthood, laying out a philosophy that women should possess the beauty of Aphrodite, the wisdom of Athena, the strength of Hercules, and the speed of Mercury, essentially arguing that women would one day rule the world. It was a philosophy that Marsden agreed with and would form the basis of his own Wonder Woman. That wasn't the only contribution Sanger had to Marsden's life, though, as she also had a niece, Olive Byrne. Olive Byrne was born on February 19, 1904 in Steuben County, New York, to Ethel Byrne, who would later open the first birth control clinic in the United States with her sister, Margaret Sanger. She attended the Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, where she studied sex and gender. In the fall of 1925, she met William Moulton Marsden, who was serving as an associate professor of philosophy. As his student, she made straight A's in his classes, despite being a B and C student overall. It was through Byrne that Marsden reportedly witnessed a baby party at her sorority, in which freshman girls dressed up as babies and had to be treated as children. She would later be made his assistant before graduating on June 14, 1926. Afterwards, she went to Columbia University in New York, not only to continue her studies, but also to follow Marston, who she had begun a personal relationship. Reportedly, Marston told his wife Sadie that either Olive was going to live with them or he was going to leave her. While Sadie was naturally upset by this notion at first, Olive did eventually provide a perfect solution for her to have the desire to have both children and a career. Thus, she agreed with Marston he could have his mistress and Olive could live with them as long as she took care of their children as she pursued her career. It remained to their dying day and made sense to anyone who knew Marston, as his future boss, D.C. editor Sheldon Mayer, once said, he had a strange appreciation for women. One was never enough. At Columbia, Olive received her degree on June 1st, 1927, with her thesis, Evolution of Theory and the Research of Emotions, a Review of the Scholarship on Emotions. The next month, Marston was appointed as a lecturer at Columbia. Byrne would drop her ambitions of a PhD to raise the Marston children, both hers and Sadie's, while Marston himself continued his ever-diminishing academic career. In 1928, he published Emotions of Normal People, A Defense of Sexuality, though the only review he got would be from Olive Byrne herself, who would become his champion throughout his life. The family deal started to bear fruit as well, as Sadie gave birth to Moulton Marston on August 26, 1928, though Marston's ability to support them grew worse as he could no longer secure a steady academic work. But then a new career came calling, Hollywood. At Universal Studios in the burgeoning film industry, Carl Emil was looking for a psychologist to help structure their films and marketing. And after posting an ad for the position, Marston immediately answered. He began by performing an experiment on January 1928 at the Embassy Theater in New York, in which women were reserved watching Flesh and the Devil, a silent romantic melodrama. From the observations, Marston felt films needed to be true, and Lemuel was intrigued. A new career was given to Marston, and what he would call the biggest psychological lab in the world, Hollywood, and he moved there in January of 1929. There he would be made the director of the Public Service Bureau at Universal and did a contest for the Man Who Laughs movie, the same film that would serve as an inspiration for the Batman villain, the Joker, in which Marston offered contestants a $2,000 prize for the best answer, why do attractive women like homely men? Something that Hollywood has always been trying to justify, along with explaining how Marston, an obese man, managed to have both a wife and mistress living under the same roof. While there, he worked at the University of California and joined forces with Walter Picton on sound pictures. Together, they wrote The Art of Sound Pictures, which was published in November of 1929, to serve as a guide on how screenwriters can avoid the censors in their stories. Marston also worked on such notable films like Showboat in 1929, All Quiet on the Western Front in 1930, and even horror films, notably Paramount's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in 1931. However, Marston soon had to deal with the Hays Code in 1930, which objected to movies showing content of low moral behavior by the Motion Pictures Producers and Distributors of America, originally called the MPPDA, and would later be known as the Motion Picture Association of America, the MPAA, the early version of the ratings board. Even worse, Universal employed Leonard Keeler to replace Marston, who had invented the polygraph in 1931, an improved version of Marston's lie detector. Keeler developed it working with John Larson, a Berkeley police detective with a PhD from the University of California for use in interrogations. While not admissible in court like Marston's invention, it's still considered more accurate as it not only measures blood pressure, but also breathing, pulse, and skin connectivity. Marston tried to set out on his own in Hollywood when he established Equitable Pictures with Picton, but the venture fell apart with the stock market crash in 1929, along with his hopes of making a New Woman film. He would have to seek a different medium for that. While Marston's professional life kept hitting roadblocks, his personal life was expanding. On January 21st, 1931, Olive gave birth to Byrne Holloway Richard, and then on September 20th, 1932, she gave birth to Don Richard. The Richard surname was from William K. Richard, her husband she met in California. However, Richard never existed. Marston was the biological father, but considering the peculiar nature of their relationship, a husband was invented to keep the secret. To signify the beginning of their relationship back in November of 1928, Olive started wearing metal bracelets as a private sign of her commitment to Marston. Bracelets looked very similar to the ones Wonder Woman would eventually wear in the comic book. To pay for this ever-growing family, Sadie Holloway continued to pursue her career while Olive raised the children. Marston continued to work odd jobs as well. In June of 1938, he even published a novel, Venus With Us, A Tale of Caesar. It was a tale of Florencia, a vestal virgin who falls in love with Caesar, but thwarted by Metella, who takes her to Lesbos bound in chains. It failed, like many other of Marston's ventures up to this point, but didn't stop him from the opportunities arose, even the most morbid ones. When Charles Lindbergh's baby was kidnapped on March 1, 1932, Marston offered his services and the use of the lie detector, but it was ignored, while Keeler received his patent on his polygraph machine the previous year and was selling it to police departments. Marston was trying to make the claim that he was the leading psychologist on deception, but was eclipsed by Keeler. Marston tried to use his lie detector on Bruno Hauptmann, who had been arrested in 1934 for the kidnapping, who Keeler wanted to use his polygraph on as well. His attorney claimed he never heard of Marston, and Hauptmann was found guilty and died by the electric chair on April 3, 1936. On March 10, 1936, Marston published the book, The Lie Detector Test, claiming that Keeler's polygraph didn't work and only humans could detect lies. He even sent a copy to the FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, for an endorsement, but instead, Hoover just opened a file on Marston. At this point, Marston's ego was getting the better of him, claiming he was the only real lie detector, completely misinterpreting the Frye ruling, which closed the case in the use of his machine in legal proceedings. Marston would even claim it was a love detector, and would frequently use it in publicity stunts. Sagi had another daughter on February 22, 1933, whom they would name Olive. They were truly becoming one big family, with William and Sadie eventually adopted Olive's children on February of 1935 to kill the guys, using the cover that they were the children of her dead husband. The one person who saw through the guys was Jack Byrne, Olive's brother and pulp writer, who never trusted Marston. Moving back to Massachusetts, Sadie went to work at Metro Life Insurance, while the family moved into William's boyhood home on Avon Street in Cliftondale with his mother, his father having died back in 1923. In the summer of 1935, they moved on to Rye, New York, where Olive got a job as a staff writer at the Family Circle, a woman's magazine, back in 1932. Her aunt, Margaret Sanger, would visit from time to time. On November 1, 1935, Byrne wrote an article under the name Olive Richard about William Marston, hiding the fact of their relationship while proclaiming her love for him and his work. She even wrote about her brother, Jack, along with her love of pulp writing. Meanwhile, while his wife and girlfriend were earning a living, Marston was up to his usual antics. On November 10, 1931, Marston held a press conference at the Harvard Club in New York City. For a two-hour speech, he predicted that women would one day rule the world in about 1,000 years, something his Olive's aunt, Margaret Sanger, would agree to. On November 21, 1938, Marston's lie detector emerged again in, of all things, a Gillette ad for their razors, claiming that the machine proved that customers like Gillette over all other brands. However, when the Detroit police tried to replicate the experiment, it failed. Then he decided to try his hand at writing again, and soon became intrigued by the new medium starting to rise, comic books. In March 1940, the publisher Jack Byrne worked for Fiction House published Amazonia, The Mighty Woman, about the last survivor of a super race that perished during the Ice Age. She is eventually rescued and falls in love with Blake Manners, an explorer on the polar expedition. Marston was interested in stories like this, especially when they appeal to his feminist nature and believe comic books could provide good wish fulfillment. Once again, peddling his credentials as a psychologist, he was hired by Charles Gaines for his editorial board at All American Comics. While there, he convinced Gaines of the need of a female superhero to serve as a role model for young girls, though Gaines resisted at first since all previous attempts had failed. Nevertheless, Marston persisted, and on February 1941, he submitted Suprema, the Wonder Woman, to Gaines. Working under his editor Sheldon Meyer, who made Marston cut Suprema and just call her Wonder Woman, he was paired with artist Harry G. Peter to craft the book. Peter was born on March 8, 1880 in Santa Reveal, California. He started his professional career as a staff artist for the San Francisco Chronicle in 1906, where he met Adonica Fulton, a fellow artist for the Bulletin, who eventually became his wife in 1912. Like Marston, Peter had feminist leanings, doing suffrage art for the Modern Woman feature in The Judge. Together, they would craft the most successful female superhero of all time. She would not be the first female superhero, though, as June Tarp Mills, a Pratt Institute-educated artist, had been producing Black Fury and later Miss Fury since April 6, 1941 in a Sunday strip for the Bell Syndicate before being reprinted in the comic book form by Timely, later Marvel, from 1942 to 1946. Even better, June operated under the pseudonym Tarp Mills to disguise the fact that she was also a female comic book artist to boot. Her comic was about a wealthy socialite, Marla Drake, who donned a skin-tight catsuit to fight crime. While popular, the strip garnered controversy with Marla's ever-revealing outfits, at one point wearing a bikini of all things in 1947, which led to 37 papers to drop the strip. Something her more successful counterpart would soon suffer as well. In crafting their own costume for Wonder Woman, H.G. Peter was inspired by Captain America, but he wanted her to be sexy, with a look based on Alberto Vargas' Varga Girl in the July 1942 Esquire magazine, which was later declared obscene in 1943. Marsden also made a decision to write in the pseudonym Charles Moulton, which was a combination of his and Bill Gaines' middle names. In his story, Amazons are a race of superior to men who have been freed by the Greek goddess of love, Aphrodite, to live in peace on Paradise Island. Diana was formed from clay by her mother, Hippola, and lived in peace with her fellow Amazons until she was rescued by war pilot Steve Trevor, who had crash-landed there. The Amazons hold a tournament to see who would have the honor of returning Steve Trevor to his country, while Diana wins and has a costume fashioned in American colors of red, white, and blue in honor of the country by Hippola. Diana would go on to America with Trevor, whom she had now fallen in love with, and adopts his country as her own, standing up for the principles of democracy and freedom. She also states that she does not kill, as it goes against the original Amazonian principles. On October of 1941, Wonder Woman debuted in All-Star Comics number 8, right when World War II was about to break out. Marsden appealed to FDR for service in the use of his lie detector, but was once again passed over by Leonard Keeler and his polygraph, which soon became a standard test for anyone seeking security clearance in the U.S. military. Despite the fact that the National Research Council concluded in early 1941 that it didn't actually detect deception. Instead, Marsden focused back on Wonder Woman, who in Sensation Comics number 2 on January 1942, she fought gangsters while debuting her invisible plane, along with one of her villains, Dr. Poison, who was working for the Nazis. Wonder Woman was instantly patriotic during World War II. Etta Candy was also introduced in the issue as Wonder Woman's best friend, and notable for the time for being a plus-size woman compared to the stick-figure women of comic books. However, she was also brave and capable, and held her own during Diana's adventures despite just being a human. Diana also took up the ego of a nurse, alter ego of a nurse at first, at the military base where Steve Trevor is stationed to keep an eye on him. Later, she would become a secretary for military intelligence, with her bosses noting how fast of a typist she was. This was a tribute to Olive Byrne, who was also a fast typist and even worked on Marsden's early scripts. On March of 1941, the National Organization of Decent Literature put Sensation Comics on the blacklist. Founded by Catholic bishops in 1938, it called comic books the disgrace of the 20th century, and with Wonder Woman because she was not sufficiently dressed. This didn't deter sales, which were exceptional, and Wonder Woman was quickly becoming one of the most popular characters on the stands. Soon, she was making guest appearances in All-Star Comics, teaming up with the Justice Society of America in issues number 8 and number 11. Then in Sensation Comics number 5, the readers were polled over who should join the JSA next. Wonder Woman, Wildcat, Mr. Terrific, the Black Tyrant, and the Gay Ghost. Yes, that was his name. And also Little Boy Blue, not the painting, an actual superhero. Wonder Woman won. On March 1942, the votes were tabulated, with Wonder Woman easily winning, though with a rigged result. Wonder Woman's picture is twice as large as the other characters, and appears multiple times on the voting page. Meanwhile, Gaines hired noted child psychologist Loretta Bender to help counter the comic book Wonder Woman critics, who in 1941 had written a journal article with a medical resident, Reginald Lorry, called The Effects of Comic Books on the Ideology of the Children, in which he concluded that comics were actually good for children outside of being dominated by men. With this and the huge sales of Wonder Woman, whenever she appeared in the comics, Gaines was finally ready to add her to the JSA, but wanted to conduct one more poll. In All-Star Comics number 11, he asked readers directly if Wonder Woman should be allowed to join the JSA. 1,801 votes were tabulated, and it was overwhelmingly yes. Broken down by gender, 1,265 boys voted yes, along with 333 girls, while 197 boys voted no and just 6 girls. Thus, Wonder Woman finally got to join the premier superhero team in comic books at the time in All-Star Comics in the August-September issue as the secretary. Marsden was incensed, as he thought Wonder Woman should be an equal member on the team and not left behind to do the paperwork, complaining to Sheldon Meyer on April of 1942. This was writer Gardner Fox's idea, who not only made her the secretary but virtually helpless, wishing the men luck as they went off to the war or fretting over the Lost Minutes book. Meanwhile, when Marsden was writing the character, she was flying off in space in a rocket while mixing in with more contemporary stories, such as battling a corrupt milk company that was tied to a not larger Nazi plot. Then in Sensation Comics number 8, she fights with a union for underpaid women at Bullfinch's department stores. When she confronts the company owner, Gloria Bullfinch, she uses her lasso to hypnotize her. At the time, it could control minds over just revealing the truth, telling her name is now Ruth Smith and must work at her own Bullfinch department stores. However, she soon learns the real villain is Bullfinch's fiancé, Prince Gyoji Del Slimo. That's a name. And when Gloria awakens, she punches him out, wishing she was as strong as Wonder Woman. Bullfinch then doubles the salaries of her workers in response. Then, in September 1942, Sensation Comics, Wonder Woman donned the identity of a lookalike, whose husband didn't want her to work, and even changed her to stay home. It was part of Martin Zars' belief, which he wrote in an article for Tomorrow Magazine in that same year, that women should be allowed to work as much as men, and later, in Pivot of Civilization, argued that only for the future was greater equality for women. On May 1942, the Women's Auxiliary Corps was formed, WAAC or WAC, was formed to help with the war effort. The intention wasn't to give women a combat role, but for them to take up the non-combat duties, thus freeing men for combat. 150,000 women signed up to serve, with Wonder Woman comic joining in the war effort, promoting it in the Sensation Comics number 20. It was criticized by feminists such as Sanger for the practice of dismissing recruits who got pregnant, but it was a large step at the time. On July 1942, Wonder Woman finally got her own comic book, the first for a female superhero, at which point Marsden dropped his pseudonym and revealed that it was William Moulton Marsden, that was the writer and creator all along. Along with debuting new villains, such as Ares, the Greek god of war. He even sent an issue to his mother, who reportedly liked it, but didn't approve of her costume. Moms. She did like the Miss Marvel feature, though. This was the Wonder Woman of history, which highlighted the great women of history. It was inspired by Alice Marvel, the top-ranked female tennis player at the time and multiple U.S. Open champion, who met with Bill Gaines about doing a feature. Gaines hired her as an associate editor, put her photo in the first issue of Wonder Woman, and paid her $50,000 for the job. Each installment highlighted a different woman, such as Florence Nightingale or Clara Barton, with Marvel doing a poll for readers to decide who should be the feature for the next issue. She no doubt by getting plenty of responses, as by the third issue, Wonder Woman was selling 500,000 issues a month. Sadly, her involvement didn't go much farther than that. Marvel was married to an army captain in 1942, and when she was 5 months pregnant in 1944, she was struck by a drunk driver and lost her baby. Soon afterward, she got word her husband had been killed in a plane crash in Germany. By 1945, she had left the country to serve the U.S. as a spy in Switzerland. The feature would continue, though, with it eventually being collected for distribution in schools. Of course, Wonder Woman comic book kept up with the comic tropes, introducing villains like Dr. Psycho in issue number 5 on July of 1943, his tribute to the late Dr. Hunsenberg, and the Cheetah in issue number 6 of October of 1943, though she didn't possess superpowers at the time till after the Crisis of Infinite Earth miniseries in the 1980s. Giganta later appeared in issue number 9 in the summer of 1944, leading to further increase Wonder Woman's rogue gallery. The person who probably wrote those actual Wonder Woman in history articles was Dorothy Rubinick, who would become National DC's first female editor. She is generally credited with creating Kryptonite for Superman in 1943, which first appeared on the radio show before the comic books, as she felt he needed a weakness. When she started working on Wonder Woman, Rubinick immediately clashed with Marsden about the persistent story device he kept using, bondage. In nearly every issue, Diana was chained or bound for one reason or another, only to free herself in the end. Rubinick found the imagery sexist and disturbing, but Marsden argued that women enjoyed submission as long as they could free themselves in the end. He used the bondage symbolic of men's oppression of women. It was often men who bound Wonder Woman, and her breaking free symbolic of women gaining equality. It was through these images that would lead to rumors that Marsden engaged in the practice himself, especially when his living situation was revealed decades later. However, his son Byrne claimed that he never observed anything like that in their household and stated that neither Elizabeth nor Olive would have allowed it to begin with. Rubiak did mandate that one woman should stay off Paradise Island, keeping her in the real world as much as possible, just as Superman couldn't go back to Krypton either. Rubiak wanted her to be a female Superman as much as possible. She also wanted the sexiness of her look played down, which as a result led to her getting a miniskirt. The binding continued, though, along with the complaints, which ultimately led to Josette Frank from the editorial board to resign over it. Gaines kept complaining to Marsden about it, but he fell back on his old psychologist credentials along with Bender, who backed them. As a result, Marsden argued that Bender should take Frank's vacant place on the board. And we'll leave you here for now. We've hit about the 30-minute mark, and I'd like to keep him around that length. When we get back, we'll get further into Wonder Woman's ever-expanding career, along with the controversies later on, and as she soon delves into new mediums.
My name is Mark McCrane. I'm the author of The Best Saturdays of Our Lives.
I'm Dan Klink, co-host of The Best Saturdays of Our Lives podcast.
The Best Saturdays of Our Lives features programming trends from the 1966 television season all the way through the last hurrah of the early digital age of the 1990s.
On the show, if it's animated, we talk about it.
Order your signed copy today at tbsool.com.
And listen to the podcast at esonetwork.com and all podcast platforms.
And now is March 28th, 2024, time for the favorite comic of the week. Ultimate Spider-Man, number 3, by Jonathan Hickman and Mark Chiquetto, which is another great issue in this new Ultimate universe that finds Peter Parker's Spider-Man finally getting his classic Spider-Man costume thanks to with the help of his daughter, Mayday. Meanwhile, he starts to get deeper into who the Green Goblin is, along with dealing with another classic Marvel villain. This is once again continuing this fantastic reboot of the Ultimate Universe that finds, of course, an adult Peter Parker married to MJ with two kids and learning to become Spider-Man in his mid-30s. And it's just great. It's great to see. This is a Peter Parker that's very funny, down to earth. He's still learning to be Spider-Man, but you can tell he loves his family. He's trying to do the right thing. And also the great twist about the fact that, like, his uncle Ben Parker is the one that is alive this time. He's also best friend for J. Jonah Jameson. They're starting a newspaper. Just a lot of fun. Gorgeous art by Pacheco. A little upset he's going to have to leave, but his art's so well detailed, you understand why he can't do a series for too many issues in a row, but love his work in general. And this is easily the best Spider-Man book on the stands right now. Easily pick it up, skip everything else. Well, maybe Miles Morales, I haven't gotten into that, but definitely skip an amazing Spider-Man, because that series is still just depressing, especially when you read something so good in Ultimate Spider-Man. It's fantastic. And also, I would be remiss not to mention how much I am loving the X-Men 97 Disney Plus revival of the classic X-Men the Animated Series show. This is a great watch. It basically picks up right up more or less after the animated series ended. And they've done a fantastic job adapting a lot of the classic storylines. Inferno got a great adaptation recently. And it's a neat twist and turns. So yeah, definitely check it out. And with that, we will conclude this episode of the Archives. Of course, this will be the... keeping in line with March being Women's History Month, we're doing the first part of the History of Wonder Woman. We'll conclude next week with the second part of this archive edition. Until then, go out and enjoy some good comic book. If you can, definitely check out Ultimate Spider-Man if you haven't already. Granted, this book he's selling out, but it's, best Spider-Man in years.